our friend, writer Colin Fleming, joins us. You can do what the smart people and I have done, and that is pre-order his latest book. It's part of the 33 and a third series, Sam Cooke, live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. Go to Amazon, pre-order, go to your local bookstore, put in a request, do what you need to do to get Colin's upcoming work. In the meantime, well, you can settle for a little 30 minutes or so of awesomeness right now as Colin joins us on the telephone line. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Kimball? Tell me, is this wrong? You know how that year that Steve Carlton was so much better record-wise than his team, and he'd come in every day, and when it was his turn to pitch, and he'd say, it's win day, baby, it's win day. When I'm waiting as you're going through your thing, I'm really tempted to be like, it's win segment, baby, but I refrain.
Well, you're implying then that the rest of our show is as bad as those Phillies were on the non-Steve Carlton days.
Everybody needs to have something to shoot for in terms of improvement, is how I feel, Kimball. That's how I'd handle something like that.
All right, that works. That works. I could.
And I'm left-handed, and I'm sitting in my bathroom. The things that go through my head, it's like I have to fill the space. You know how it is.
I do. Now, while we're on that subject, I know you were a very good hockey player. Did you play baseball as a kid?
I did. And it's funny, a couple years ago, someone from my youth reached out to me, and this was in Connecticut. So we moved from next to Foxborough, this town called Mansfield, to Connecticut when I was like, I don't know, 11 or 12. And I was a first baseman, so I threw lefty, and I hit righty, which I didn't realize was that strange at the time. And this kid said to me, well, I mean, this grown man now, he wrote me, and he said, I found these archival things of you in the Ridgefield Press, like the town newspaper. So when you came to town, we thought you were this ringer because you were so good, and you had your own first baseman's mitt, which you didn't have, like, really at the time, but being a good fielder and being left-handed, I didn't have a lot of options. So my dad said, so it will be with the first baseman's mitt. And it's funny because I was okay, but I was nowhere near as good as I was at hockey. And I think actually, ironically, I sort of stuck to pitching. But this kid, he was talking about me like I was some flamethrower. I'm like, yeah, those were the days.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Well, let's talk about the first item on the agenda. We've got a lot to cover today, but a wonderful recent piece you did in Jazz Times. I knew very little about Scott LaFaro, so it was fascinating to read about him and then go off and learn more about a guy who was not around for very long, but certainly made an impact on the jazz scene.
Now, did you know about him maybe without knowing that you knew about him? Like, did you know those famous Village Vanguard recordings that were, that's really what Scott LaFaro, the bassist, was known for, was his work with Bill Evans's trio. And they made a highly beloved couple of albums over a Sunday at the Village Vanguard in New York City in 1961. And it's like both of those two records, Sunday Afternoon at the Village Vanguard and Waltz for Debbie, they're like high up on many people's all-time favorite album lists, especially people who like jazz. So you would have come across that trio perhaps at some time, but LaFaro died, as you said, exceedingly young. He was 25. And normally when we say that about a jazz musician, unfortunately, because it happens so often, we're talking opioids. We're talking some sort of crisis of the soul that burbles over into a physical crisis. And even when you have people like Billie Holiday, she's only like 44, Lester Young, I believe, was 49. A lot of times these people were not terribly long for the world, but you can find a lot of jazz luminaries who were snuffed out in their mid-20s. And actually what happened with LaFaro was just days after being at the Newport Jazz Festival, he died in a road accident and was taken. And this guy is, oh, I don't even know like how low I'd want to place him, but yeah, I think you could comfortably put him in one of the half dozen best bassists in the popular music medium in this country. I mean, he might be him or Jimmy Blanton, who played with Ellington's band and also died really young, even younger, actually. I think they're probably the two best jazz bassists that there's ever been.
And as you mentioned, he made it more than a bass in many ways. How did he do that?
Well, we've talked about Keith Moon before and how Pete Townshend would play lead guitar via playing rhythm, because the lead instrument really in The Who were the drums. And that was liberating, but it was also not how drums had ever really functioned. Like in jazz, you could be a drummer who was a band leader, like a Buddy Rich, and you'd take the solo, but you still weren't like really the lead instrument necessarily in the band. And the same goes for the bass, the rhythmic underpinning instrument. And of course, jazz bassists could do wildly inventive things with the bass, and that had been going on for a while before Lavaro came on the scene. For instance, like Jimmy Blanton is there in the 40s doing the thing that Lavaro is going to, I don't want to say build off of, but do his own version of that. And he was really the lead voice, the lead instrument within this trio. And that freed up Bill Evans, who was a highly melodic player. I mean, you'll know Bill Evans because I think at some point or other we talked about the cluster of albums maybe around Miles Davis's Kind of Blue. So Bill Evans was on that date, and he was largely responsible, along with Davis, for the melodic emphasis of Kind of Blue. So what the piece does is it looks at Lavaro, apart from his work with this defining and legacy defining for him trio and other recordings he made. Like, for instance, you really wouldn't expect, maybe, Scott Lavaro to show up at Ornette Coleman's free jazz date. Lavaro had a very busy Christmas season, as did Eric Dolphy, in 1960, where it's so cool, these guys, when you look at the chronology, I mean, I identify it with like how my own life is. It's like you're creating something on a Tuesday, and then you're doing this completely different project on a Wednesday, like you would have been based in the New York City, New Jersey area, and you're just bombing around like that. So he's there at this free jazz, and if people haven't listened to free jazz, I would recommend that straight away. It's one of the most intense experiences in listening you can have with Western music.
I don't know if I've told you this, but I always score after our conversations brownie points with my father-in-law, who is a huge jazz fan, jazz scholar, and I will say, hey, I was talking with my friend Colin the other day about Eric Dolphy, and he'll say, oh, well, let me tell you about this. Let me play this for you, and he'll get out the vinyl and listen. So I look forward to exploring Scott Lafaro even more with him next time around.
So you go up in his esteem?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, mostly because of you. But that's, you know, it's esteem by association, which is frankly what I get from you every week.
I had this agent once back when I would do like the agent thing. This guy was completely useless, and we had moved on from each other. He despised me, and I just thought he was completely incompetent. And we were interacting one time. He's a Mets fan, and he said to me, and he wasn't joking, this is like over Facebook Messenger, he's like, I take all the things you say about baseball, they're so intelligent, I pass them off on my own with my friend. You're such a douche.
This wow.
Yeah, and he's and like, he wasn't, because he was witless. So it wasn't even like a playful kind of like nice way about you kind of thing. Like a guy like you have like an old timey compliment. You have a nice way about you. So he was actually just helping himself and going to some town there for some plaudits with his buddies, so he could like theorize on, I don't know, Daryl Strawberry and what might have been.
Wow. Well, check out Colin's piece. It's his. It's his writing. It's his genius in the new Jazz Times. And also, speaking of jazz, at the Smart Set, a new piece on Toni Morrison. And as you explain in this piece, you came to her writing and you were familiar with her jazz, that writing, before you were pretty deep into the idiom of jazz itself.
Definitely. And I guess I should preface this by saying that I don't really think a lot of Toni Morrison's writing. I don't think she's particularly good, but what would have happened is that, I'm sure you're familiar with this, if it's something that still continues on, like when you're going to be in an advanced English class or whatever, I don't know, like going into your junior year of high school, you know how you're like just given that like parcel of books to
read? Right.
And it's like that, like over the summer.
Here's
like
your reading list. Books. Yes.
Yeah. And she was, and she probably still is, she was like a staple of that kind of list. And so I was reading jazz, and it would be a while before I was going to get into jazz. I got into jazz, like, it's funny, because when I started out writing, I was in college, I wouldn't go out at night. I would stay in, and I would, like, write. But they were all, like, music pieces. And I wasn't doing fiction at the time. I remember you see him on the email chain, Norberg. He said later to me, he said, redeem thyself, fool. Right? He would have said that like in 96 because he saw something. And I knew I'd eventually get there. But I was just like writing these record reviews. And later I became the person who did everything and did everything equally well. But when I was just writing about music, I sort of had Toni Morrison in mind too, because there's a lot of kind of jazz rhythm, it makes sense, in this book. And I got this idea in my head that what you're writing should in some way complement, kind of a silly idea. It wasn't particularly sophisticated, and I moved on from it, but should somehow complement like the style of the music. And it's a limiting thing, but I remember like writing these record reviews, like Bruce Springsteen, this kind of like, it wasn't Nebraska, but there's something after that. There was like Ghost of Tom Jones. I remember like trying to do like this Americana type of thing. And it was fumbly and awful and awkward. Still better than what everyone else writes right now, but it's nowhere near as good as what I became. And it just was something in my mind that got me to think, I guess I'd say, about the relationship between sound and sense. So you can have this book that you don't really think that highly of, by an author you don't think that highly of, that can still sort of springboard you into a different sort of avenue than you might have otherwise just leapt to on your own at that point in your own development.
It's very interesting because I also, and I, it's blasphemy in some quarters, I'm also not a huge fan of Toni Morrison. I haven't read jazz, but now I feel like I ought to go check that out just to see if I can feel what you felt from it. And I thought it was interesting too when you say that in terms of its plot, it's in many ways like the northern version of Faulkner.
I think it tries to be like the 1920s Harlem version of that soupy kind of Faulkner plot. It's very much like a Harlem intrigue of the jazz age. And I would say that one thing that's important, really, it's kind of the root of what I do. It's just like telling secrets out of class, as they say. But like when I'm writing about something, that's kind of like the big trick. I'm never actually writing about the thing I'm writing about. Never. Now, I know more about that subject than anyone else is going to know. And you can get the factoids and everything and all of that. But if you're just writing about the putative subject, you're going to leave people behind. You have to be writing about things that everyone can connect with. And nobody does that. Like, if I sent you a piece on Beethoven by someone else, I'd be doing that if I knew you'd like Beethoven, because if you weren't already into Beethoven, that's not going to hold anything for you. And so if anyone goes to my work and you think, oh, I don't like whatever the given subject is, it's really not what it's about. It's ultimately going to be about you. And it's going to be about you in perhaps ways you don't see yourself yet, or ways you just started to, or ways you might in the future, or ways you used to. But it's never really even just about Toni Morrison, even though in a piece like this, I'm certainly parsing the language, but I think that's what other writers do. They're not inclusive. They leave people behind. If you don't dig Schubert, if you don't dig Maya Angelou, there's nothing there for you. And so Toni Morrison, ironically, was kind of like that way for me. I'm thinking like, there's not a lot here for me. I'm not seeing some sort of image or any revelation about myself, but I get what she's doing with the language.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Let's move on to talk about some actual music and a couple of live performances here, starting with Bob Dylan at an interesting point in his career, live in Philadelphia in 1964. It's a fascinating recording because in many ways it captures him before all that was to come with the events of 1965, his motorcycle accident, and all that's come since then.
We timed this well, right? Is what I was thinking yesterday when those 56-year-old charges came out that now Bob Dylan is being sued for something he allegedly did a long time ago. But this tape, this Philadelphia audience recording. So what we mean by that is somebody like there made it. So if you're only going to listen to pristine sounding music, and you have to have the right kind of headphones and like earbuds are beneath you, this would take some adapting to. But really, it's not that bad. And there are only three full concert tapes from Dylan in this year of 1964. One of them has gained official release. It's the Halloween show which is weirdly edited down for reasons I don't understand. I think we talked about that once on Amazon. There's another from England. But this is him in Philadelphia, and you can hear him starting to become, like, he's big, but you can hear him starting to become bigger. And it's just a performance that blends a kind of feral quality with control. And what I mean by that is, if you listen to Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, it's like this heavy metal, intense, Wagnerian version of this plaintive folk ballad. Like, you wonder when you listen to it, especially at the beginning, he's shouting. He's like John Lennon, Twist and Shout, shouting this song that you wouldn't think you can shout, but it works. And you think to yourself, like, what got into this guy? Did something happen to him last night? Did he have some sort of, like, crisis, or did someone leave his life and he didn't want them to? But it's that involving, that ingratiating.
And I've seen Dylan a few times, but only in larger settings. And it's fascinating to hear this and think, although this was pretty good size setting, but think what it must have been like to hear him in those early days in the coffee houses.
You do get a feel for the room, and that's to the credit of this audience recording. Like, you can tell when he's moving about on stage. It's weird, though, with Dylan. You get that a bunch because, like, even, like, the Manchester Free Trade Hall show from May 17th, 1966. So he's up there at that point with the band. That's the famous or the infamous Judas concert where someone yells that out. They don't like he's playing electric music. But when he counts in like a Rolling Stone at the end, he does so by like stomping his boot, and you can hear his boot on the stage. Like, you wouldn't think you'd be able to hear something like that. So, like, Dylan bootlegs, and, well, I guess that's official now, but they pick up all of these interesting found sounds that add to the story. And I love that kind of thing with live recordings. I remember the first real sort of big piece I thought I did in my career was on the unreleased recordings of the Stone Roses. And it began talking about this gig in Germany in the fall of 1989. And they're at a club. So just sort of like how Dylan was with his coffee houses. And they're like playing fine. They're okay. And you hear someone playing billiards. And they break, and you hear the balls going opposite, like, all the different directions. You can hear it in the recording, and you can tell that the Roses, they get pissed that people aren't paying attention. And it becomes like this death throttle from then on out when they play the most intense music of their career just to, like, put it up the, like, German arse of this person who had the nerve to play billiards. So you get sort of those elements, too, with Dylan, and to see him in a coffee house, because I think I told you, like, joking around with a friend, like, you go into a bar and you go look at the person playing in the back, and you want it, most people, they want it to be someone who sucks so they can, like, try and impress, like, their lady friend. You don't want it to be, like, circa 63 Dylan. And so this is him just after that, and of course you can go and listen to him in 61, 62, 63, but he just was so different than the guy, like, busking in the common that I might go past.
Another live recording from several years later, 1971, live at Leeds, the Rolling Stones, part of what I guess was a brief tour of England and Scotland over the course of just 3 weeks in early 71.
Brief, yes. The Stones have, like, these strange brief tours where you can get these live recordings. This was a bootleg for a long time, but, like, you can hear them in Hawaii in 1966 and, like, in Australia. And they were well-preserved by the bootleggers. But this particular recording, which came out as part of a deluxe edition of Sticky Fingers, it's, well, I told you to pay special attention to Midnight Ramble. Like, it smokes, doesn't it? Like, it's just crazy good, this wall of surging rhythm coming at you, where they have the twin lead guitar thing between Keith Richards and the mercurial, the band changing, the legacy changing Mick Taylor doing their thing.
My only issue with it is, and this is why generally I'm not a big fan of live albums, unless I happen to be there. If it was a concert I saw in person and I want to experience that again, but I don't know. It felt like, to me, about 9 minutes of harmonica. And then the very self-indulgent, let's slow it all down. And I don't know, imagine that probably Keith is doing God knows what when Mick is singing. I didn't enjoy And I know the legend of Midnight Rambler is great, but I didn't enjoy this version all that much. Obviously, being there live, I'd have had a very different experience.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know if you'd have like this to me is the museum piece, Midnight Rambler, because there are a lot of Midnight Ramblers. They're like, okay, let's sort of like get through this. And they have their moments, but they're inconsistent within the unfurling of their own performance,
yes,
if you will. This is the tight museum piece. I can't believe how good these guys are. I mean, I've all the thousands and thousands of Stones things I've listened to since I was 15 years old, and it's like this is the bee's knees, to put it in the Toni Morrison 1920s jazz parlance. And the harmonica is never functioning in isolation. The harmonica, right, is always doing this kind of duet. It's sometimes doing this strange tetralogy duet with the bass and the two guitars. So there's like this polyphonic sophistication going on. It's something that little Walter, with his marvelous blues chromatic harmonica playing, would have listened to and gotten some ideas off of Jagger. So in some, bad Kimball, bad.
Yeah, it doesn't do it for me. Sorry.
Oh, you with your bread and your air supply and your Captain Tennille, you're like, I like melody. Melody and hard rock never mix in the world of a Kimball.
No, there are moments when it does. But yeah, because here's what happens. You pay for tickets to a show, and I've been to an awful lot of concerts in my life. You pay for tickets. Me personally, I don't mind a little improvisation. I want to hear the musicianship. But dear God, I don't need 13 minutes of just about anything, particularly unless it was 13 minutes when you did the studio version.
Kimball, we've been through something like this with the Stooges, and that's when you premiered your line about the, and then that took you down, man. And then we had that whole Golden Girls thing last night, or I was watching Golden Girls last night. I'm thinking, Kimball, I bet this guy is slacking off and still has not attended to this yet. And now here we are, but we talk about yacht rock one time, and you're like, oh, there's nothing like Christopher Cross. He reminds me a lot of a Crosby himself between Pascal and Kant. What the hell is
you misrepresent me, Fleming. You misrepresent. Look, I like all kinds of music. I do not like the self-indulgent rocker that was epitomized by some of these live performances.
Yeah, I go back and revisit that one sometime. Maybe if you have some spare time when you're not checking out when you're militantly avoiding. Let's put it that way. The Golden Girls, which is the only way you could have gone through life. Maybe they're twined, Kimball. Maybe you needed to experience them, Blanche. And last night's Christmas episode is great. They had the men of she had a calendar of naked men that she humped, and it was the men of Blanche's boudoir. And so maybe if you got like that, you would have gotten some of the French symbolist references within Midnight Rambler, and we'd be having a different talk. And a year from now, you'll be like, Fleming, I have to confess, I am drunk again. Like, all right, well, work on that. You'll be like, I have to atone. I have to wear a hair shirt. I'm like, it's fine. Just work on it, man.
I have watched some episodes of The Golden Girls. Not enough to consider myself.
You're going to say you're not a fan.
No. I want to have a track record. I need to have a lot of episodes under my belt so I can have an intelligent discussion about it. I will say this. My mea culpa right here. I misjudged the show in my youth and my inexperience and my Saturday night liaisons, whatever the hell I was doing in my 20s back when it was popular on Saturday nights, but I wasn't sitting home watching television. But now, especially when I think about some of the people I was with in those days, I clearly would have been better served watching The Golden Girls.
I learned last night that it is coming to select theaters. I wrote about it on the blog today in September. And if I had a life and was not daily fighting to avoid offing myself, and we lived in the same place, and I was happier, I would drag your ass out to that theater, and you'd be like, "Can I put a seat between us?" I'd be like, "No, we're shipmates on this, Kimball. We're going to be closely proximate, and we're going to be proximate in spirit to the girls, and then we go to a cafe Dylan wouldn't be there, but we could have a lengthy talk about which girl we like the most. I'm a Dorothy guy. I could see you being a, probably Dorothy, but maybe Rose.
Bro, I'm all over Rue McClanahan, always. Even pre-Golden Girls.
Yeah, she's good. Well, they were all good, and it's just, I've probably seen that episode with the whole Men of Blanche's boudoir calendar, and it's like, it's so ribald in a way, because what you probably haven't seen that particular episode is Dorothy looks at it, and that's how you can tell that they're all naked. And she says, I'm surprised after Mr. September that you could walk in October. Now, come on, who is like a completely crass, vulgar, like, I mean, that's wrong. I feel like out on a limb if I was saying that on my own on the air, but I can pass it off as someone else. But like, it's the type of thing, if I was texting that to somebody, I'd make very sure that I had the right address and not send it to the wrong person who might like object or report me with some of my texts.
All right, it's not Golden Girls, but a fine film all the same. 1953's Invaders from Mars. I love this movie.
You'd seen this one?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Now, I think of this almost as the young adult version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Absolutely.
It's like for a 12 or 13-year-old, because it has a similar premise. I mean, it's 3 years before, and it was rushed out. So it could be the first in color. Again, it's 1953. Like, we sort of take it for granted that something might be in color, but it wasn't that common, just because Wizard of Oz in 1939, but still, like, black and white was the go-to until this decade. And then it still, like, hung around well into the early 1960s. So this kid was 12, probably. He's looking out the window, and he sees there's this sand pit over this path, which is kind of like the one bravura set of the entire film, and he sees the ship land, and he's into looking at the stars, and his dad is too, and the aliens are, you never know what they're really like, their ultimate objective is, but they're sort of taking over, and they're putting like the screws at the back of people's heads. His dad gets converted into one of these aliens. He falls into the sand pit, and the spaceship is underground. How about when the dad smacks the kid across the room?
Yeah.
Isn't that shocking?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I saw the movie, I don't know, I must have been maybe 9 or 10 when I first saw it. And at the time, that actor, Leif Erikson, was on a Western that I used to like as a kid called The High Chaparral. And I'm like, oh, my God, there's something. What's he doing? What's wrong with him? The aliens clearly got him.
and this would have been a film, too, that just played a lot. I think it would have been like, if you didn't catch in the theatrical run, if someone was around at the time, it would have been like on TV.
Oh, yeah.
Would have like had matinee, like re-showings, like probably for a long time. It was probably like a lot of people's like first like scary movie that you went to with your friends. And so I like when the mom, she's like, she's pissed that she's been woken up, and she's like complaining because she doesn't like to get up before like 7:30. Like, that's early to them. I'm thinking, like, you lazy, like, cow, you really need to like start your day a bit earlier. 7:30. She's like, I'll sleep in. And so this kid sort of spearheads the solving of this mystery. There's this social worker type who becomes like sort of like oddly touchy feely with him. And she has this guy she likes. And a scene that stood out to me too is when they're trying to like find this solution to the problem in the laboratory. There is the biggest, tallest door in the history of cinema. When you're like this door in this lab, and people just open it, it's like 50 feet tall. Isn't that just so weird when you watch? Like, who designs a door that's like, it's like the Hall of Justice door? It's really strange.
And I love that there's similar ending to Invasion of the Body Snatchers. The idea that his parents reassure him, oh no, honey, you just dreamt this, and then boom, it's back. Yikes.
That's the American ending. The British one is like, no, we're not messing about with.
Oh,
is it a dream? They're like, this is real. It sucked. Things are going to get bad. And they were more sort of like definitive about how it worked out in the end. It's worth mentioning, too, because I imagine he felt like he was sort of slumming it here. Milburn Stone.
Yes, from Gunsmoke.
Of Gunsmoke is in this. and you can't not hear Doc. And it's just like he really just had the voice to be Doc. I feel like he like his voice is that sort of avuncular doctor voice, and the compadre who like you go to, you're Matt Dillon, and you need some like extra help that Kitty can't give you. You need some like he's like the sort of the Yoda of Gunsmoke, and until like Festus comes along, and then he's like this weird sort of like crazy Yoda who occasionally is profound. So it's not like. And the director of this film worked on Gone with the Wind, and another well-known, and sometimes people think it's a classic, sci-fi film from the 30s called Things to Come, which is actually sort of pompous and kind of boring and long-winded. But this guy had, like, real cred, William Cameron Mendes. So it wasn't like this just hodgepodge robot monster type of deal. That kind of film is fun. But this was a concerted effort to come up with something of some cinematic value.
I love it. Invaders from Mars, 1953. By the way, I don't believe there was any help that Miss Kitty couldn't provide to Marshall Dillon. You know what I'm talking about.
Right, but she was also so in love. And as you often say, when you're waxing romantic, that love can sort of be akin to a pair of blinders on the head of a horse. Like, what is up with this dude? Like, he's telling me the Stones suck. He won't watch Golden Girls, Head of the Horse, and Content. It's like, oh, rich guy, what am I going to do with you?
I'm going to go home and work on my harmonica solo for next week's segment. In the meantime, get online, pre-order Colin's newest book. It's Sam Cooke, live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963, part of the 33 and a third series. And we'll do what we do right here. Next Tuesday afternoon. I thank you, my friend, as always. We'll see you in a week.
Okay, sounds good.
Colin Fleming on Downtown.